this is, maybe some people in this room probably know all of this, but for those of us that are sort of new to this tradition, do you mind giving a little bit of an overview of, like, who your teachers were and are, and maybe also, I know that both Tucker and Renee are kind of on the path of becoming teachers, but if it's appropriate to talk a little bit about who maybe you're training and things like that, just to kind of give a little background.
Yeah, sure. My background, I began to see myself as a spiritual seeker when I was about 15, and took a lot of directions that didn't work out, including I was raised in an Episcopal church, but I became a Catholic and I ended up in a seminary where I became a priest, and that was totally disillusioning. And I engaged in a lot of the psychedelic activity of the 60s as a spiritual pursuit, which was very beneficial. It opened me up to a lot of things, and it made it obvious that that mind-altering substances were not the answer. And that led me into Vedanta, the Advaita Vedanta, and but there weren't any teachers available. And then the Beatles brought Maharishi Mahesh, and finally found somebody who could teach me a meditation technique that was actually, you know, it was the first time I had direct contact with somebody. Myself and another graduate student spent many hours trying to meditate based on books, and, you know, there's a difference. But anyway, it wasn't until, let's see, I was about 22, I guess, or let's see, no, 27, that I met a Buddhist teacher, Kama Nanda, and he was my first teacher, and I didn't really know much about Buddhism before that, but I spent time with him in another context, and in that time, he kept talking to me about Buddhism, and I became more and more interested, and then he invited me to come to a meditation retreat. Kama Nanda was a student of Namgyal Rinpoche. And Namgyal Rinpoche had originally been ordained as Ananda Bodhi in the Theravadan tradition. And he was a very successful, highly attained Theravadan Buddhist who had been sent to England and established a meditation center in London and then another one in Scotland, which exists to this day in what's it called now? Anyway, it's the one that Chogyam Trungpa ended up being at for a while. But it started out. It started out Thai, but because Ananda Bodhi was ordained as a Theravadin. Then he adopted a style of teaching where he would go on trips with his students, and they would travel to various places in the East, and they would be teaching and meditation as a part of it. And so one of these trips led them to, here's where my memory deficit comes up. I can't remember the name of the town that the Karmapa lived in. But anyway, they stayed there, spent time with the Karmapa, and the Karmapa recognized Ananda Bodhi as the tulku of Namgyal Rinpoche. And so he reordained in the Tibetan tradition, and he took to the Tibetan teachings very strongly. And so that's what he taught, was something that was really cross-traditional. He took the best parts from both traditions, and that's what he taught. And then my second teacher, who was a teacher for the longest time, showed up. He returned from Southeast Asia from 7 years in a monastery, Jodhidhamma Bhikkhu. And he was also a student of Namgyel Rinpoche Gump Ananda Bodhi.
Namgyel's picture is on the altar.
Right? Yes, right. That's Namgyel there on the altar. And I don't wonder if I have pictures of Jodhi in here. I had a picture of King Ananda, but people thought it was too wild.
It was wild.
King Ananda is a wonderful wild man. And so this was my background. I was strongly encouraged to explore a variety of traditions and to practice in the particular practice that I teach and do. I started out doing the Mahasi style dry vipassana practice, the noting practice, and that's what I first learned from Kema and did with him for well over a year, including some longer retreats, 3 week and 3 month retreats. And then that's when Jodhidhamma came back from Southeast Asia, and I said, you know, I've been doing this for a long time and it's not working for me. And he said, oh, well, why don't you try doing some of the original Buddhist practices? Because, you know, this was in the 70s, you know, he said, that was only invented about 100 years ago. Nobody ever did it before then, so fine, you know. So, oh yeah, I like this. Tell me more. So, I started learning and doing samatha practice. And so there's always, it goes beyond just a mixture of the Theravadan and Tibetan, primarily Kagyu Tibetan, because I had this previous interest in Advaita Vedanta and other things. And so the way I am, when I look at any two things like this, I see how they're the same. I don't see how they're different. And so I'll look at something from a tradition that I haven't had anything to do with, and I'll write, oh, that's the same as this other thing. And that will trigger my interest, and I'll explore those. And that's kind of the direction I've gone with things. Well, there was a point at which the smells and bells and yells and everything of the Tibetan thing just, you know, I had enough. You know, and it was pretty much probably precipitated as well by the fact that I was married. I married a woman who took Kripasa coordination from Kema at the same time I did. And people don't become schizophrenics unless, you know, they have inherited those tendencies. But then it usually takes something to trigger that. And doing the traditional Tibetan visualization practice triggered a total schizophrenic breakdown in her. And that also was enough, you know, because the essence of these tantric practices is basically you pretend and make believe until it starts to come true, at least in your own mind. And that's not a good thing for schizophrenics to do. And I think there's a whole lot of people that aren't schizophrenics that it's not a good thing to do either. I think it's an extremely appropriate practice for a certain kind of culture which exists in Tibet. So I dropped the whole Tibetan thing for a long time. Didn't drop it entirely. I love the art. There are a lot of things about it. But...
Some people have to leave at 10.
I'm so sorry to be... I don't mean to disrupt. I just have to get a plane. So
all right,
so
you
sorry.
Go ahead and do that. And I'll try not to go on too long.
No, I... Please go on as long
as... Anybody else has to as well. But anyway, then a few years later, another important teacher came along by the name of Michael Harmer. Teaches shamanic practices. He's actually started out as an academic, traveled all over the world, different shamanic cultures, studied them, and developed basically what he considered a theory of the core shamanism. And as I learned about that from Michael Harner, I understood the entire Tibetan tradition in a way that I never had before. Because it was a shamanic culture. The goodbye. Blessings
Bye.
On your trip.
Bye.
Thank you so
Safe
much,
travels.
Everyone.
It was just so wonderful to be with all of you. Thank you so much.
Yes.
See you again.
Bye, darlings.
Bye. It was a shamanic culture to which Buddhism was introduced, and it was and is an amalgam of those things. And so so that allowed me to understand it in a way that I hadn't before. But anyway, as I continued to practice and study and learn with different people in different situations, in a way, I would compare myself very much to Michael Harner. I feel like I'm doing the same thing with Buddhism that he did with shamanism. Is that I'm discovering the common core to all these different forms of Buddhism. And at the same time, what I'm finding, you know, I have studied the Pali suttas a lot, and I've read the scholars who have analyzed those works from many points of view, from the philosophical, the linguistic, the historical, and things like that. And from all of that, I've come to a place where I feel like I can clearly see what I call the Buddha Dharma, the teachings of the Awakened One that are contained within those scriptures, and that have been carried on in all the different forms of Buddhism. But I can see that, and I feel like what happens now to me is I can sit down and I can read sutras. And when I can do, it's almost as if certain passages are highlighted in different colors. And some colors, this is what the Buddha said. And some colors, this is what somebody else said, thought he should have said. Right? And what I see is all of those passages in all of those different sutras that are highlighted in a color that means this is what the Buddha said. They form a very coherent pattern. They jive perfectly. There are no conflicts. Whereas if you look at the sutras, just take them at face value, they are so full of conflicts and contradictions that it just positively drives you crazy. But if you can get that mental highlighter working, you can say, oh, this all makes sense. Right? If you leave out these parts. And what I find, there's a consistent theme in all the parts that you could almost do this yourself with a highlighter and go through and everything that you see that you know belongs to another religious tradition, particularly one that existed prior to the Buddha, and you cross that out and then you read what's left and it makes perfect sense. The other little trick to that is that you take into account who the Buddha was talking to and what he was talking about. So if he was making a point about such and such to a group of people who held this particular belief system, he may well have made all kinds of references to things within that belief system, pointing to this thing that he was trying to explain. And that doesn't mean that he subscribed to that belief system. It meant that he was trying to get them to understand this. This is what he was talking about. This is what the name of the sutra says. And this is what the original question was about. And this is what he was trying to get to. So if he made a lot of references to other things that those people believed in the process of it, it doesn't mean that the Buddha was teaching that this is the truth. And so, yeah, I feel like, I feel kind of like the Michael Harner of Buddhism in the two senses that I can appreciate this consistent core in all these different teachings. And at the same time, I feel like I've found the key to reading the sutras that allows you to make much more sense of them. So, and then what I teach in terms of meditation, the primary source is my own experience. But one person experiences things in only one way. And so, as every new retreat goes by and every period of time that goes by, what I teach becomes enriched by everything I've learned from everyone else in their interviews and watching as they've progressed and seeing how they've gone through the same stages, but they went through them in a different way and they experienced them in a different way. And so it just keeps getting richer and more complete as a result of that. To the point now that a lot of the things that I teach are things that I learned from observing other people even more than they are from my own experience. Because there's certain kinds of things, like all these energy experiences that we talk about, that I've only had in a minimal way. And so I really do rely on what I've learned from other people for those.